Welcome back to the Average Joe Sports Show, a sports podcast created by sports fans for sports fans, produced and distributed by Planet Comedy. I am your host, Kyle Ritchie, comedian, content creator, nerd, sports fanatic, defender of the innocent, protector of the weak, and all-around good guy. On today's podcast, college basketball national championship games occurred over the weekend, both the men and the women's. We talk about what happened to both those games and the effects on Caitlin Clark's legacy, UConn winning its second straight national championship. John Calipari packs his bags and heads from Lexington to Fayetteville as he takes over the Arkansas Razorbacks college basketball program. Who's going to be next at the University of Kentucky? The Rasheed Rice situation and all of the fallout surrounding it. NFL draft rumors as well as free agency updates. NBA MVP race between guys like Luka Doncic, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Nikola Jokic, and much more. UFC 300 and a legendary card with some two championship fights. The NHL playoff race where we have some great young teams, great young players. Who's going to win the Hart Trophy and much more. Check out other podcasts produced here by Planet Comedy, including the Planet Comedy Podcast, where me and my good friend Cam Hobson tackle our favorite topics of the week, do some Would You Rathers, as well as some other fun segments. Check out the Diversity in Life podcast as well, hosted by Kristen Lee and Devin Ray Stidham, where they explore everything outside of the box. If you want to broaden your horizons and learn something new, check out Diversity in Life today. Check us out on social media at Average Joe's, The Average Joe Sports Show on Facebook, Average Joe Sports Show on Instagram. On YouTube, you can find us at Planet Comedy, where we post all the clips from this show as well as our other podcasts. Same thing on TikTok at Planet Comedy. You can follow me on Twitter at Stoplight Jesus to get updates about the show. And follow me on Twitch as well at Stoplight Jesus for some great Twitch streams. And enjoy the rest of today's podcast. Buenos dias, my people. Welcome back to Average Joe Sports Show. We are here for episode number 2, dose, if you will. Back at it once again as we cover everything going on in the wild world of sports. We're going to get started with what went down Monday and Sunday night, which is the NCAA championship game results. You know, the NCAA tournament, March Madness, ended for the women and the men on Sunday and Monday, which means we have some game results. In the women's side of the bracket, it was the South Carolina Gamecocks taking on the Iowa Hawkeyes and Caitlin Clark. The final was South Carolina 87, Iowa 75. South Carolina had four players in double digits, with Tessa Johnson leading the way with 19 points. Camilla Cardoso added 15 points and 17 rebounds. Chloe Kitts had 11 points and 10 rebounds. South Carolina dominated the boards and on defense and routes to their third national championship as a program. Dawn Staley stamped herself as the new standard of college basketball as she wins her second championship in 3 seasons and cements herself as probably the most dominant figure in the sport going today. Not historically. Historically, that's probably Gino Auriemma. On the Iowa side of things, I mean, first off, let's just, I want to give a little bit of credit to South Carolina. Undefeated season for them, 38-0. They are the, I want to say the third or fourth team to do this on the women's side of the bracket, go undefeated and win a national championship. I can't remember the last time. I think the last time it was done in the men's was in the 70s by an Indiana team. But, I mean, a huge accomplishment for South Carolina. Really cements them as one of the blue bloods of college, of women's college basketball, that is. And a great accomplishment for Dawn Staley. This program has just been on the up and up ever since she arrived there, won their first championship in 2017, won another title, I want to say, in 2022. Yeah, because last year it was LSU. Probably should have had 3 straight titles, but Caitlin Clark, the person they faced in the title game, prevented them from getting that second title. She was excellent last night on the Iowa side of things, 30 points. Struggled a little bit at times. Did some great defense from the South Carolina women. Kate Martin and Hannah Stukely did their best with 16 and 11 points respectively, but Iowa just couldn't keep up with the depth and size that South Carolina had. They just couldn't, you know, match up player for player with the Gamecocks, and that kind of came to tell over time. Clark kept it close in the first half, but South Carolina ended up pulling away in the second half, right around the third quarter, I want to say, with a kind of a big stretch. Caitlin Clark's college legacy is currently being debated, which is a wild thing to me. There's the debates going on around Caitlin Clark are like, is she the greatest women's college basketball player of all time? I would say no. Probably the greatest college basketball player women's wise I've ever seen is either Brittany Griner or Breanna Stewart. But in terms of impact, Caitlin Clark is the most important player in the history of women's basketball, period. Not just college. I mean, she's the most important player in the history of women's basketball, period. The championship game on Sunday night had 24 million viewers. I want to say that again. 24 million people tuned in to watch the national championship game for women's college basketball. That's more than any NBA or any NCAA college basketball game, men or women's, that ESPN's ever had. I mean, it is the most viewed basketball game in the history of ESPN. And that is a gigantic, I think it's the history of ESPN. At least it's the history of ESPN in terms of like NBA and all that, like in terms of basketball. That is, I mean, I cannot even overstate the impact of what she's been able to accomplish and what she has brought to not only the University of Iowa, but to women's basketball, period. She's the most important player in the history of women's sport, of women's basketball. She's brought more eyeballs to the sport and more notoriety to the sport than anyone in the history of the sport, maybe outside of Cheryl Miller. And I don't even know that Cheryl, because it's really hard to find videos of Cheryl Miller. So I would say that she's probably the most important. I don't know if she's the greatest. Although one thing I want to kind of dispel, one thing I want to get rid of before we get too deep into the Caitlin Clark discussion. Doing count the rings in college is stupid, because college is not built like that. I mean, you can, especially with the way college athletics just kind of operates in general, I mean, you can't really hoover up championships like you can in the pros, because these kids can only say a grand total of 3-4 seasons at the most, and most of the time, especially in basketball, they say like 2. So some of the greatest college players we've ever seen don't have titles. I mean, let me think about it. I mean, Derrick Rose never won a championship in college. He's one of the best college basketball players I've ever seen in my entire life. DeMarcus Cousins, John Wall, a lot of guys you can think about have never even sniffed a national championship in college basketball. So the idea that Caitlin Clark is disqualified from GOAT discussions, from the greatest ever discussions, just because she's never won a title is silly. But count the ring commentary is stupid in general anyway, even in pro sports, but especially in college athletics. It's ridiculous to even suggest the idea that someone can't be the best ever in collegiate sports because they never won a championship. I mean, Larry Bird never sniffed an NCAA championship, and he's one of the greatest basketball players that's ever walked the face of the planet. I think Magic only won one, and that was because he went to Michigan State. It's just it is a weird place to stamp yourself on the Caitlin Clark never won a national championship banner of someone who scored more points in college basketball than anyone, men or women. So let's just stop that there. Whether or not she's the greatest women's basketball player ever is up for debate. What's not up for debate is she is the most important women's basketball player that's ever lived, because 24 million people watch that game. And I guarantee you, 24 people, as much as I love the South Carolina and I love my Gamecocks, 24 million people did not watch that game for the South Carolina Gamecocks to go undefeated. They watched that game for Caitlin Clark. So, great two seasons for her. Great two seasons for the Iowa Hawkeyes program. She's off to the WNBA draft. Most likely to play for the Indiana Fever, it would seem. I mean, I can't imagine them picking anybody else number one. But congratulations, Caitlin. Good luck in Indiana. I'm sure we will welcome you here with open arms. On the men's side of the bracket, things went pretty predictably. UConn 75, Purdue 60. UConn has won its second straight NCAA championship, which is a big deal. I think the last team to do that was the 06-07 Florida Gators. They had four players score double digits. Oh, here comes the queen bee. Well, I have the camera facing at me. Nobody can see you, so you're good. Unless you just want to pop in frame real quick.
No.
No? All right, then. But Connecticut had four players score in the double digits, including 20 from guard Tristan Newton. They dominated the boards, had a great defensive performance. The game plan for UConn seemed to be just let Zach Edey do whatever the fuck he wanted and then kind of, you know, control everybody else. Basically, they were like, we're going to make somebody else beat us, which is a smart game plan. It's what Tennessee tried to do in the Elite Eight game, but it didn't really work out because Purdue hit a couple threes, and that was really the difference in the game. UConn did a great job. They've been a great defensive team all season. They've defended the three really well, and that proved to be very potent in this national championship game because they kept everyone from Purdue, everyone not named Zach Edey from Purdue, pretty much out of scoring at all. They kept Purdue at arm's length pretty much the entire game. It got within single digits at times, but it never really felt like Purdue was ever within shooting distance of the Connecticut Huskies. This is the 12th straight tournament win by double digits. That's the most all time by, I think, three or four games. These last two tournaments, UConn has won every single NCAA tournament game by double digits. That's insane. This is one of the best runs in the history of the sport. Dan Hurley deserves all the credit here because as much as, you know, these obviously the players, but as much as we love these players, this is a whole new starting five pretty much from last season's champion. And they were even better this year. Won a school record 37 games. I think only lost two or three. They dominated the NCAA tournament just like they did last season. And I mean, they have been one of the teams that when you watch them play basketball, you're just like, this team is just head and shoulders better than everybody else in the field. I think if you did this tournament 10 times, this is why I went on the rant I just went on about Caitlin Clark and the idea of doing count the rings in college and being like, oh, they never won any championships in college type thing. If the NCAA tournament is one of the most unpredictable things in sports, like, just because you can catch a team on a hot shooting night, catch a player on a hot shooting night, anything like that. And, you know, in a single elimination tournament, when you invite 68 teams, anything can really happen. This is one of the years, I think, if you did this tournament 10 times, this Connecticut team would probably win it eight out of the 10 times. Maybe once or twice you'd catch a team on a real hot night and they'd upset them. But 8 to 9 out of the 10 times you play this tournament, I think you'd have UConn winning. They have been that dominant over this two-year stretch. It's one of the most dominant, one of the most impressive two-year stretches in the history of college basketball. That being said, on the other side of things, on the Purdue side, Zach Edey did all he could. He had 37 points, 10 rebounds. Didn't get a lot of help. Braden Smith was the second leading scorer with 12. All-time great season by the Boilermakers. They just ran into a juggernaut. I mean, there's nothing more you can really say. Credit to Matt Painter. Credit to Zach Edey. Zach's probably not going to be, you know, a superstar NBA player, if I had to guess. Just doesn't have the athleticism for it. He could be a pretty good role player, you know, an Ivan Zubac type. So, but he's an all-time great college basketball star. Two-time player of the year. I mean, had a super impressive tournament. Dropping 37 and 10 in the championship game is crazy. But like I said, UConn just kind of decided that they were going to let Zach Edey get his and make somebody else beat him, and nobody else could beat him. And that's been the formula for beating this Purdue team, is just to kind of let Zach Edey cook and then beat everybody else and then keep everybody else out of the buckets. So credit to the Boilermakers, credit to Matt Painter. I'm sure they'll be back. I'm sure we will see more of them, hopefully, in the Final Four in the future. But like I said, they ran into the juggernaut of college basketball right now, the standard bearer. I mean, UConn has won 6 championships in the last 25 seasons, 4 in the last 15. So they are the standard bearer of college basketball right now. And that's a perfect transition to the former standard bearer of college basketball, which is the Kentucky Wildcats. They are looking for a new head coach because John Calipari has agreed in principle to a 5-year contract to take over the Arkansas Razorbacks. That's right. He's leaving, bouncing from Lexington to Fayetteville. This Arkansas program has a lot of money. I mean, they have those boosters, the guys who, you know, put the money into the Arkansas football and basketball programs. They got a lot of money to spend, and they're finally spending it. 5 year, I think, slightly getting to less money than he did at Kentucky, but that makes sense. But around $28 million a year. Also, it's a big, you know, big thing for Kentucky. He leaves behind a complex legacy at Kentucky. Obviously won a championship in 2012 when he had Anthony Davis, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, you know, that team, Patrick Peterson. Four Final Fours in 2011, 2012, 2014, and 2015. He had a 410 and 122 record. But the last four seasons are kind of where Kentucky fans and the Kentucky administration, I think, has kind of spoiled or soured on Cal. They've all the last four seasons, I think 4 years ago, they missed the tournament entirely. They were just, I mean, they're just outright bad a couple years ago. And then 2 years ago, they were knocked out in the first round by St. Peter's. They get lost in the round of 32. I can't remember who two. And then obviously where the pressure really came from was this season. That 80-76 loss to Oakland when that Jack Gulicki kid went off. That was when Kentucky fans, you really started to hear it from fans, from the media, like the internal pressure to get rid of John Calipari and move on to a brand new head coach. Kind of turn the page in Lexington. So this move kind of works out best for both parties. It saves Kentucky $33 million in a buyout and saves Calipari the embarrassment of potentially being fired by the University of Kentucky. So it really works out best for the university and for the head coach. Congratulations to Cal. He's going to Arkansas to get paid, son. Arkansas fans are super excited. They should be super excited. Cal is a hell of a recruiter. So I guarantee you this. They will get talent down in Arkansas. Arkansas will be good. I mean, if you're a Kentucky fan right now and you're thinking that Arkansas is going to fail or Cal's going to fall on his face in Arkansas in some way, you need to get that out of your head right now. The term's relatively, and what do you mean by fail? Do I think they're going to, you know, become a juggernaut like Connecticut is right now and win, you know, multiple national championships? No, probably not. But will they be a competitive basketball team that's a top four seed probably every year in the NCAA tournament? Yeah, probably, because that's Cal's history. I mean, his history dictates that they're probably going to get a lot of guys who are going to go to the NBA. They're probably going to get a top four seed in the NCAA tournament every year. And then what happens from there will be interesting. But, I mean, that's what they're going to do. I mean, they're going to be a good basketball team. Realistic Kentucky head coaching candidates, like the guys that I think are realistic for Kentucky fans. Now, let's get this out of the way first. UConn head coach Dan Hurley, Alabama head coach Nate Oates, and former Villanova head coach Jay Wright have all reportedly already turned down the job. I saw where Mitch Barnwell, I want to say is the name, the AD over at Kentucky, basically said that he had a blank check for Dan Hurley. But let's just be real. What is the benefit of going from UConn to Kentucky at this point? He's won two national championships at UConn. He's potentially building them into the next great modern dynasty in college sports. And he doesn't have to deal with the unrealistic expectations of a fan base that, for some reason, believes that they are the kings of college basketball when they haven't really been the kings of college basketball in about three decades. So let's just be real here. There's no benefit besides money of going from UConn to Kentucky. So we all kind of knew, but I do respect that. You know, you have to make him say no. You have to ask. You got to call Dan Hurley. Ask a question, make him say no to you. Alabama head coach Nate Oates, it really surprised me that Nate Oates just kind of flatly said no to this job, because this does seem like a step up from the Alabama job, and he's exactly the kind of coach that you would think would take a job like this. So it's shocking to me that he's going to stick around in Tuscaloosa. I guess it shouldn't be, considering that he signed an extension just last year. Give me a sip here, ladies and gentlemen. But yeah, I guess it shouldn't really shock me that he's going to stick around. He just signed, I believe, a $24 million extension last season. And Villanova head coach Jay Wright, or former Villanova head coach Jay Wright, who's won two national championships himself, he's one of these guys that he just seems like he's content with his life, not coaching. He doesn't seem like he really wants to get back into coaching. He doesn't seem like he's very interested in it. He just kind of seems like he is enjoying life outside of the coaching world. So let's just clear those three off the board right now. To me, though, that's Nate Oates has kind of openly already turned down the job. Same with Jay Wright. Dan Hurley reportedly hasn't turned down the job to Kentucky officials yet, But publicly, I would say he's going to turn down the job, and he's probably not going to be the next Kentucky head coach. These are the real choices. So first things first, Chicago Bulls head coach, Billy Donovan. Billy Donovan obviously was the coach. I want to say he was the coach when they won the back-to-back national championships down in Florida. So this is the last guy to do what Dan Hurley just did. And he's currently he's coached twice in the NBA. He was successful in the NBA. He was a good coach for the Oklahoma City Thunder back when they had Russell Westbrook and Paul George on the team. He's been a solid but not great head coach for the Chicago Bulls. It seems pretty likely that he's going to get let go this season, so that's why this is getting brought up a lot. I could see this happening. I think if you threw enough money at him, he would be enticed to return to college. Now, the question would he be interested in the transfer portal and NIL? I don't know about all that. I don't know if Billy would be interested in doing all that. He may be, and he's one of these guys that he may genuinely enjoy the NBA more than he does the NCAA, so he may stick around. One guy that has been brought up a lot in the NBA circles is Boston Celtics executive and former head coach Brad Stevens. I don't see this at all. I just don't see a world in which Brad Stevens, who did coach at Butler, who coached them to the, we all remember the back-to-back national championship games appearance for the Butler Bulldogs. That was Brad Stevens' team, and before he got to the Boston Celtics job, I just don't see Brad Stevens coming back to college. I think if he's going to go back to coaching, it'll be in the NBA, maybe even the Celtics. These are the two realistic choices to me. Auburn head coach Bruce Pearl. Bruce Pearl was the head coach of Tennessee when the Tennessee men's program before this most recent kind of resurgence from them was on top of the world. And then he got in trouble with some NCAA violations. I don't know if it was NCAA violations or if he just got into some kind of personal trouble. But he ended up getting into some trouble, I can't remember if he got fired or if he resigned. And then through, a couple years, he ended up back as the Auburn Tigers head coach. And he's got Auburn rolling. Now, the interesting thing about this is Auburn also got knocked out in the first round this year by Yale. So it kind of, to me, feels like this is a lateral move almost, as much as I like Bruce Pearl. I think he does an excellent job recruiting. He does an excellent job coaching. I don't see how there are some Kentucky fans out there. I don't see how this is any different than having Cal. I mean, this just seems like Cal. This seems like having Coach Calipari with new paint. I mean, you got a guy who's had a couple early first-round exits with great teams at Auburn. He's got a lot of NBA talent down there at Auburn. I don't see the appeal for Kentucky fans. But there are a lot of Kentucky fans who really want Bruce Pearl, who want them to basically write Bruce Pearl a blank check to come coach in Lexington, and that just seems very odd to me. And then there's Baylor head coach Scott Drew, who has connections to Barnwell, who is a certified program builder. He built Baylor into, damn near not having a basketball program anymore, to a national champion. Baylor has been consistently good, consistently a top 5-6 seed in the NCAA tournament. And like I said, they had the 28-2 year when they won the national championship, and everybody was like, whoa, look at Baylor. That's my prediction, too, by the way. I think that's who they end up hiring. I think at the end of this process, we are going to get Kentucky's new head coach is going to be Scott Drew from Baylor. To me, it just makes the most sense, especially given his connections to the AD and how that kind of gets handled. I don't see Kentucky going out and getting one of these big-name head coaches mostly because I don't see these guys wanting to go to the pressure cooker that is coaching in Lexington. Donovan, Drew, and Pearl seem like the really realistic candidates. Pearl, like I said, just kind of feels like an extension of the Calipari era. If you're going to go hire Bruce Pearl, why not just keep John Calipari? They're basically the same coach. I mean, that's, Bruce Pearl and John Calipari are basically that Spider-Man meme of them pointing at each other. They're the same person. To me, Scott Drew makes the most sense. He's a real tempo change from what Cal was. He's a true program builder. He keeps his guys in-house. And he's, Cal's whole thing is the one-and-done thing. And I think that's mostly what Kentucky fans are done with. So if you want to get rid of that, just, go to the opposite, which to me is Scott Drew. So that's my prediction, is that the Kentucky Wildcats end up hiring Baylor head coach Scott Drew to be their new head coach. Moving to the NFL, where we are going to do some NFL headlines. Obviously, the big thing going on right now is the Rashee Rice thing. Rashee Rice, the wide receiver for the Super Bowl, the two-time defending Super Bowl champion, Kansas City Chiefs, a big part of their playoff run, was involved in a hit-and-run incident on Saturday night in Dallas. The reports indicate that there was a street race between a Corvette and a Lamborghini where both drivers lost control and caused a multi-car accident. Rashee has actually come forward and admitted that he was the person driving the Lamborghini. Rice's lawyer has said that he is cooperating with authorities and that the lawyer expects charges to be filed against Rashee in the coming days. It seems to me the most likely outcome for this legally, we're talking just in terms of like what's going to happen in the legal process, is that he's going to plea. He's going to cop a plea deal. He's going to plead guilty to a lot of the charges they're going to give him in order to avoid jail time, would be my assumption. And here's the thing. This isn't a Henry Ruggs situation because, as far as I'm aware, nobody's been seriously injured, thank God, from this incident. But, I mean, he did break a lot of laws. I mean, fleeing the scene of an accident is a felony. He was reportedly seen grabbing firearms and money out of the car, which is also a felony. Street racing is a felony. So he's going to face some very serious charges. But my expectation legally would be that he's going to plead guilty to some of these charges and that he's going to get put on some form of probation / house arrest. And he's not going to serve any actual time in jail or prison for what happened. The other thing for this is what the NFL is going to do. He's for sure going to get suspended under their personal conduct policy. 100% they're going to suspend him. The question is, how many games? If I had to guess, if I had to put my money on it, I would say it's six. That seems like a good number. Six games seems like eight is the most, because it's about half the season, and I really could see that. It just depends on how bad this gets for him. But eight games is the most I could see. Six feels like the most likely. Four would almost be a slap on the wrist. But I would say 4 to 8 in that range is kind of what you're looking at. But, I mean, let's just be real. This is a disaster. This is a PR and real-life-on-the-field disaster for both Rashee Rice, who was a, like I said, really came on in the postseason, really started to establish himself as one of the, like, premier young receivers in this league. Going through the playoffs, this is a disaster for him. I mean, this is something that could not look worse for Rashee Rice. And this is why, you know, when in the NFL draft, when they're talking about drafting people, this is why when you look at, like, character issues, I always want to know, what is the character issue? I need specific. Because when you look at, like, because, like, Baker Mayfield, they always said he had off-the-field character issues. Well, his off-the-field character issues are, like, you know, he was arrested. Everyone remembers the video of Baker getting arrested, tackled by the cop, and arrested, for the public intoxication. But stuff like that's pretty easy, you know. Yeah, it's immature, and yeah, it makes you question, like, can we give this guy hundreds of millions of dollars? But you don't suspect that, you know, he's going to go to prison or anything like that, or he's going to do something that's going to, you know, make, you know, humiliate you as an organization. You just kind of think he's kind of dumb, but he's, you know, at the time Baker was 22. He was a young guy. You know, he was enjoying life. Like, there's a difference between off the field concerns in terms of discipline and this, because there were off the field concerns for Rashee Rice coming out of SMU. And that's why he dropped so low where Kansas City was able to get a hold of him. And now you kind of see that come home to roost. I see this more as like a Jalen Carter situation where it's going to, and not in terms of like the impact, because what Jalen Carter was involved in cost one of his teammates their life. But in terms of like the impact of what's going to happen, to me, it seems more likely that he's suspended for about 6 to 8 games. He cops a plea deal to not serve jail time. Now for Kansas City, this is a disaster in multiple ways. One, it makes you look awful. I mean, it's always a bad look to have one of your players involved in something that is, one, so clearly stupid, and two, I mean, blatantly illegal, blatant, you know, disregard for the safety of people and the law in general. But not only that, now they have to kind of devote serious resources about what they're going to do at wide receiver. Now, they did sign Hollywood Brown on the offseason, so that's going to kind of make a big difference. And there's always a chance they could bring back guys like Mecole Hardman or go out and, you know, in the free agency and pick up some secondary receivers. Jesus. But I think the more likely scenario is that they probably will take an opportunity in the draft, either in the first or second round, to pick up a guy. Now, they need a corner now that they potentially, they need a secondary piece now that they've traded away L'Jarius Sneed. But they are, it seems, with Rasheed likely gone for 6 to 8 games due to the NFL's personal conduct policy and over this whole situation, they're going to have to invest at some point in the first, second, third, fourth round at a wide receiver and get somebody who can help Patrick Mahomes. Because Patrick Mahomes goes out there and all he's got to throw to is Travis Kelce and Hollywood Brown. I think the Chiefs offense is going to look like a lot like it did last season. I know they just won a Super Bowl, but we all forget they look stagnant and awful. So this is just an unmitigated disaster for really the whole Chiefs organization in a way. And I hate that for Patrick, and I hate that for the Chiefs, but their three-peat is not starting out great. Moving on to some off-season moves, Mike Williams and Tyron Smith both signed with the New York Jets, making them the oldest and most injury-prone team in the NFL. Jonathan Hankins is going to sign with Seattle Seahawks, and Lions defensive end Romeo Okwara is retiring at age 28, which you see this a lot more now, like with guys like Chris Borland, Luke Kuechly, all these guys who are retiring super early. Give me a sip. You know, it's more common, I think, than we were accustomed to. Back in the day, you know, like Ray Rice and all these guys had 10, 15-year careers. You know, these guys are retiring after eight seasons in the league, and it's kind of shocking to see. But it shows you really how valuable these athletes' time in this sport is, and it really shows you how rare it is for a career to go, you know, 15, 20 years. Stephon Diggs, this is the big one, was traded to the Houston Texans. The Houston Texans are pushing their chips to the middle of the table, ladies and gentlemen. I talked about this on the social media channel. I referenced both the Bills' point of view and the Texans' point of view. They added Neil Hunter, Joe Mixon, and now Diggs. They're clearly looking to capitalize on CJ Stroud's rookie contract. Puts a lot of pressure on the team, though. I mean, this is now eyes are on you. You know, last year they kind of snuck up on some people because, you know, at the beginning of the year they were bad. At the beginning of the year they were mediocre. But we all were watching Stroud, and we were just like, that guy's good. But, the Texans themselves were mediocre. And I believe they snuck up on some people. And now they're not going to sneak up on anybody. They're fully expected to win that division. They're fully expected to be one of the top, I would say, three, four teams in the conference. And CJ Stroud is expected to make a big move and become one of the top-tier quarterbacks in that. I can hear Steven. But yeah, CJ Stroud is expected to become one of the top tier quarterbacks in the AFC moving forward. I mean, that's a lot of pressure to put on a young kid. That's a lot of pressure to put on a young team, and they have a tough schedule in 2024. I mean, they have away games at Dallas, at I want to say at San Francisco. Obviously, they play their division. They play, I want to say, Kansas City. They play Baltimore. So it's going to be tough, and it really begs the question, like, are the Texans contenders now? I'm not going to answer that question as of right now. On paper, yes. On paper, they should be legitimate contenders in the AFC, but I would like to see what they're going to look like for the first 3-4 games before we really try to put big expectations on this Texans team. Looking at the Cowboys offseason, because this has been a big topic of discussion. Obviously, we lost. You know, I am a lifelong Dallas Cowboys fan. Anybody who knows me knows that. My lovely fiance, who's in the other room making our dinner, often brings that up to me. That, you know, she always makes fun of me for it. We lost Tyron Smith. We lost Tony Pollard. Leighton Van Der Esch retired, and then Michael Gallup also left. We signed Eric Kendricks and C.J. Goodwin, which it wasn't. wasn't a great offseason for the Dallas Cowboys. I mean, I'll be the first to admit that. However, people act like the sky is falling, and I don't really feel that way when it comes to free agency. In terms of our free agent, our losses, and the guys we did or did not bring in, I really think people kind of overrated that. Like, the idea that we were going to spend $20 million to bring in Derrick Henry, or, you know, $37 million to bring in Saquon Barkley, or to go get Christian Wilkins. So, you know, people just needed to be more realistic about the kind of free agent period that Dallas was going to have. Because I'm about to get into some of the contract situations that we have. But positions of need, like the positions we needed, positions we still need, are like interior defensive linemen, in this order, interior defensive linemen, defensive back, tackling linebackers, and then a running back. Because here's the thing, we were the number one scoring offense in the league last season without a great running back. So I think we'd be fine with just an okay running back that we draft in like the fourth round. Really, we need guys to stop the run. That's what we need more than anything. And then maybe a DB to put across from Trayvon Diggs. A thing I've pitched a lot is we draft Kool-Aid McKinstry. But that being said, just looking at some of the, obviously I talked about the Dak Prescott situation on the social media page, but like Dak is going to have to play out the final year of his contract. It's starting to really look like it's looking like Jerry is willing to put his money where his mouth is and just let Dak kind of play things out and figure out where he's at as in terms of play before he pays him. CeeDee Lamb, just now we are hearing reported that he is potentially going to hold out over his contract situation. And that, you know, he's going to sit out the first little mini camps and the first, which is expected. And here's the thing, CeeDee's going to get paid. Like, that's the thing people keep talking about. When everyone's bringing up free agency, these are the things I was bringing up. CeeDee Lamb is going to get paid. But the question is going to be, how long is this going to drag out? Like, what is CeeDee Lamb going to miss? Is he going to miss all of training camp? Is he going to miss just the, you know, unmandatory workouts? Like, how long is it before we just decide to just pay the dude? And then Micah Parsons' contract, there's rumors that he's unhappy with the Cowboys, but you've never heard that from Micah. He also needs a new contract, but he's been franchise tagged. And I have faith that Micah will get taken care of in pretty quick succession. Looking at the NFL draft, which is happening at the end of this month, baby, we're going to do some news and rumors. Caleb Williams looks like he's a lock for number one at this point. He's only visited the Chicago Bears. He's not really visiting with any other teams. They traded Justin Fields. They rant and rave about Caleb. He just seems to be locked in as the number one overall pick at this point. Jaden Daniels now is rumored to be number two because Cliff Kingsbury, who we all know played really well and worked really well with Kyler Murray, has been rumored to like what he's seen on film more from Jaden and prefers kind of his style of playing quarterback as opposed to someone like Drake May or J.J. McCarthy, which is crazy to me that J.J. McCarthy was ever going to be considered for the number two pick. But it seems that Cliff Kingsbury prefers Jaden Daniels and that he's near a lock to be the number two pick. Scouts are questioning the consistency of Drake. Like, that's kind of the big thing I'm hearing about Drake May, is that his issues consistently playing well game to game, that he's kind of an up and down guy in the same way that, you know, Jordan Love was in college, or Josh Allen, scares them a little bit because, you know, sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. The question I've asked about this is, to me, Drake May is one of those guys that it just depends where he goes. You know, if he goes to New England where they don't have any offensive talent and he's going to have to do it all himself, that could be a real problem. But if he lands, you know, hypothetically in Minnesota where he has connections with Kevin O'Connell, And I do think that's who they're targeting. I think this J.J. McCarthy stuff is all smokescreen. I think they're trying to convince someone to move up and take J.J. so they can get Drake May, because there's, you know, Kevin O'Connell coached Drake May during one of these the summer camps, and Drake is friends with Kevin's kid, so I could see him landing with the Vikings. Speaking of J.J. McCarthy, he's firing up draft boards unexpectedly, which shocks me because he was not a great, it's not that he wasn't great, he just wasn't a very productive player at Michigan. I mean, he just did, it was a lot of handing the ball off. They had a great run game. J.J.'s one of those, like I said, when we first started covering the draft, he's one of those players that, you know, sometimes he'd look like a, you know, that's a top five pick in the draft, and sometimes he'd be like, that's a fifth rounder. And it's wild to me that he's a big, strong-armed kid, so it makes sense kind of throughout the, you know, we've seen this so many times in draft history where these big, strong-armed quarterbacks, 6'3", 6'4", shoot up draft boards because they, you know, they can make all the throws in their combine. And JJ has something that a lot of them haven't had, which he was very successful in college. I mean, he won a lot of football games, won a college football national championship. And he is, I mean, there were times where people were talking about him being the number two pick in the NFL draft or the number three pick. And I can't see, but I will say this. I don't think he makes it out of the top 10. This could be a wild first round, y'all. I mean, we could see four quarterbacks off the board in the first four picks. I think we're seeing four quarterbacks in the first 10 picks regardless, but I mean, we could see a lot. The wide receivers have gotten interesting. Malik Nabers had a very impressive pro day. He ran a 4.33 in his pro day. Is the pizza done? Oh, Lord. I'll get it in a second. All right. Yeah, he ran a 4.33 in an impressive pro day. And it made people question who's truly the number one receiver is. Didn't help that Marvin Harrison Jr. just opted out of pro day workouts. He just said, nah, I'm good. I'm not going to be doing that. If you want to see what I can do, watch the tape, as he put it. Is this going to hurt him? Probably not. Somebody's still going to pick this guy in the top 10, probably in the top 5. But Malik Nabers did himself a lot of favors. I mean, he looked like a freak at his pro day. I mean, he had a huge vertical. He ran a 4.33, like I said, and he looked dynamic. Looked like a Tyreek Hill light, if you will. This could all, how this works out, who goes first between these two guys, because this is who the argument's between. I mean, Rome Odunze is very solidly stuck at three as the third best receiver in this draft. So whoever doesn't get Marvin Harrison Jr. is getting Malik Nabers. It all really depends how the draft order shakes out. I think if Arizona ends up stuck at four, you know, let's say New England trades out. New England doesn't want one of the, you know, let's say Caleb Williams goes first, Jaden Daniels goes second. Caleb is, you know, New England's iffy on Drake May. They trade out. Minnesota jumps up, takes Drake. And, you know, now you're Arizona, you're stuck at four. I mean, unless you can find somebody like the Denver Broncos, trade up to four, and I don't think Denver has enough. Or, you know, unless you find a team that trades up to four to pick a quarterback, I think you're going to stay there. And I think if Arizona's sitting there, they have been in love with Marvin Harrison Jr. during this process. I think if Arizona ends up stuck at four, they pick Marvin Harrison Jr. and then the Giants, unless they pick J.J. McCarthy, pick Malik Nabers at six. But if the Cardinals trade out, I could see the Giants picking Malik Nabers anyway. Or maybe the Chargers even. The Chargers could pick Malik Nabers if they get stuck at five. It all depends on how the draft order shakes out. Odunze is kind of stuck at three. He's the guy that's going to go, you know, he's going in that 5-9 range. Like whoever, you know, once you get past kind of Arizona and New York, we're going to have a situation where somebody's going to pick Odunze in that area. Defensive players are kind of in a weird spot this year. Jared Verse is now considered kind of the top edge rusher in this draft class over Dallas Turner, with Leo Latu from UCLA not far behind them. Dallas Turner and Jared Verse are kind of, I would pick Dallas Turner only because the history of Alabama football and Nick Saban guys going into the NFL, especially on the defensive side of the ball, especially on the defensive line, on the defensive front, is so awesome and is so clear-cut successful that it would be hard for me not to pick an Alabama product. But Jared Verse is a good player, man. Somebody's going to get a dude with Jared Verse. And that's kind of what kills me about this draft, is there's so much offensive talent. There's so many good prospects on offense, from Brock Bowers to Jerome Odunze to Malik Nabers to Marvin Harrison Jr. to the tackles, Joe Alt, and you know, I can never pronounce his name correctly, from Penn State. You have so many great players on the offensive side of the ball that some of these teams are going to get steals on defense. Quinyon Mitchell, who's considered the top DB prospect, along with Cooper DeJean from Iowa. White corner, baby. We got to bring that up. Cooper DeJean, bringing back the white corner, the first white corner I've ever seen in my 28 years of existence. It's going to be a first-round NFL draft pick. But Quinyon Mitchell from Akron, he's going to be the top DB off the board, especially with the Kool-Aid McKinstry injury. The Falcons, the Broncos, the Colts, all potential landing spots for these defensive players, because these are teams that I think the Broncos, if they're not picking a quarterback, I think might pick defense or offensive line. The Falcons, I think, are a lock to get one of the edge rushers. They're either picking Jared Verse or Dallas Turner, in my opinion. And I think the Colts need a corner. I mean, that's kind of open. Because Colts prognosticators were calling for Tre'Davious White. I think it's much more likely they go out and get Quinyon Mitchell in this draft, which would be awesome for the Indianapolis Colts. And, you know, like I said, it's going to be an interesting draft for the defensive players because there's so much talent on the offense. But moving on to the NBA, the MVP race, baby, heating up. Nikola Jokic, who has, you know, obviously been the fucking man in the NBA for like the last 2-3 seasons, he is the front runner at the moment. I believe he's averaging 28-10, 28-11 at the moment. But he's been slightly less dominant as of late, these last couple weeks, because of an injury to Jamal Murray. And when Jamal Murray's not playing, the floor doesn't space out as much for Jok. So when the way the Nuggets run, like, Murray is such a dangerous shooter. Kentucky product, by the way, Jamal Murray. John Calipari recruit, Jamal Murray. But he's such a good shooter. He's such a dangerous scorer that you can't really crowd the box. Like, I think a lot of people would want to against Jokic. Like, preferably in a dream world, if you're going to try to defend Nikola Jokic, you would just crowd the paint a little bit. Now, yes, Jokic is an incredible shooter for his size, but, you know, you would take away his easy baskets and you would force him to work for every point he got. Problem is, when you have a guy like Jamal Murray playing on the same team as him, that's almost impossible to do, because now you have a guy that he can just flip the ball out to, because, you know, Nikola Jokic is one of the greatest passers in the history of basketball. He can just pass the ball out to Jamal, and Jamal drops 36 on you. Well, all of a sudden, that's a giant problem, because now you have a guy, you know, you have Jokic putting up 30, 10, and 10, and then you have Murray putting up 34 and 6. That's impossible to defend. I mean, that's kind of the thing. When both these dudes are healthy, they're almost impossible to keep out of the basket. But now that one is injured, we're kind of seeing that they do really need each other, because teams, you know, and again, it's not like he's playing bad. You know, these are guys who are all in the MVP race, so he's still putting up, you know, I think, you know, 28, 10, and 8. But, you know, his effectiveness has gone down just a little bit. Speaking of effectiveness, Luka Doncic has charged the Dallas Mavericks. I mean, first off, he's averaging 34, 9, and 8, which is fucking bananas. I have never in my life seen someone who can just dominate a basketball game like Luka Doncic can. I mean, 34 points, 9 assists, and 8 rebounds is nonsense. So statistically, it's not even really a competition. Luka should be the MVP statistically, and now he's backing it up with the winning. That was the problem all season, is the Mavs were just kind of terrible all season. But then they went out and got P.J. Washington. They got some floor spreaders. And now, I think they've lost, like, what, 2 games in the last, like, month and a half? And he has been, you know, he's got them all the way up to the 5 seed, which is charging him up MVP ballots. I think really right now it's between him and Jokic who's going to win the MVP. And my vote would go to Luka. If he's able to get them, keep them at the 5 or the 4, in my opinion, and he averages 34 points, it's got to be Luka Doncic. You have to give the MVP to him, in my opinion. Now, they probably won't, because, you know, history, even though it's not supposed to, it's supposed to be season to season, does weigh into these discussions, and the fact that Jokic didn't win last year, and a lot of people think he should have, and then he ended up winning the championship and the finals MVP and having this historically great run in the NBA playoffs, I think is going to influence people to inevitably choose Nikola Jokic to be the MVP this season if it's close between the two of them. But in my opinion, Luka Doncic has been the NBA MVP this season. I mean, what he's doing. And then Giannis. Giannis is having probably his best statistical season. He's averaging close to 30. I think he's got 20, 28. He may be averaging 30. I think he's averaging like 30 and 10. But the team, ever since trading for Dame, has been a little disappointing. You know, the Bucks haven't exactly been the juggernaut that I think we all thought they were. I think we all thought at the beginning of the season that the Bucks, it's the Bucks and the Nuggets and then everybody else, and that we're going to get this Bucks-Nuggets series, and then this is going to be an incredible showdown between the two best players in the world. And it hasn't really been that way. Really, it's been the Celtics who've kind of been that team in the eastern side of things, where we think it's going to be a showdown between the Celtics and the Nuggets. But that's not through the fault of Giannis Antetokounmpo. Giannis Antetokounmpo is having statistically his best season that he's ever had. I mean, offensively, at least. He's dominating the offensive side of the ball. And he's such a good two-way player. That's the thing for him that he has over Jokic, is he is infinitely a better defender than Jokic is. The problem is Jokic, his ability to control the game is so much better than Giannis's, because Giannis doesn't have a great shot. That's kind of the argument between the two, is Jokic is the much better shooter, so therefore he's, you know, he can't, you know, if you crowd the paint, he can just fucking bomb it over you in three, whereas Giannis has trouble if they crowd the paint, it's hard for him to score. But Jokic is an okay defender, but Giannis is a great defender. And it's unlikely that Giannis is going to get the MVP this season, just because his team hasn't been the juggernaut that people thought they were. They've really struggled in the last month, and it's probably going to keep him out of MVP conversations. But I just wanted to bring it up because I think when a guy of Giannis' stature, one of the top 50 players probably in the last 50 years, is it having his best statistical season, that has to be brought up when you talk about the MVP. Speaking of the MVP, we have to talk about the playoffs. The playoff push this season to me is a sign that we are in a full passing of the torch moment. We are watching the NBA torch get passed to the next generation for sure, 100%. Because, you know, when you look at, you know, the teams at the top of the East, like the East, these are the 10 teams that are going to be competing for the East playoff spots. The Celtics, the Bucks, the Cavs, the Magic, the Knicks, the Pacers, the Heat, the 76ers, the Bulls, and the Hawks. The Celtics have, you know, obviously Jaylen Brown and God, I'm blanking on the name, but you guys know, Jason Tatum. Those are two young, budding superstars who are kind of, and we forget they're young, how young they really are, because they've been so successful so early on. They made a finals, been to a couple of East finals. I think they're both, I mean, a couple years under 30, both 27 maybe, and they are incredible. Obviously, Giannis and the Bucks with Dame Lillard, the Cavs, Donovan Mitchell, and, oh God, what is his name? The other guard for Cleveland. Darius Garland is one of the most underrated players in the NBA, and to me, they kind of exemplify this youth movement. The Magic, who quietly have one of the best defenses in the NBA, they put you through hell for 48 minutes. And they have built in this incredible young roster with this litany of like top five draft picks that they drafted in the top five, it felt like for a decade. And now that's finally starting to reap the rewards. The Knicks, who have been one of the most exciting teams, Jalen Brunson, maybe the single most underrated player in the NBA. I mean, that dude is balling. I think in the last six games, he's averaged 33 points a game. Credit to the New York Knicks for seeing something in Jalen Brunson that a lot of teams didn't see. They have built one of the Knicks are one of those teams that, like, they were just so garbage for so long that I think it's hard for people to accept that they are a pretty good NBA team now. Like, they're not great. They're not, you know, the Celtics, the Bucks, the Nuggets, the Timberwolves. You know, they're not the top tier of the NBA, but they're in that next tier. I mean, they're a pretty good NBA team, and I think it's hard for people to accept that because, God, they were just such dog shit forever. I mean, my entire adult life, basically, besides, like, 2 years with Carmelo, the Knicks have been just rancidly horrible. The Pacers with Tyrese Halliburton, who is a superstar waiting to have, who is a superstar player. He's awesome. And then the Sixers with Embiid and Tyrese Maxey, who has established himself this season as the clear number two guy with Joel Embiid going forward. They're going to have to pay him a boatload of money to be Joel Embiid's co-star moving forward. I'm happy for Joel that he finally found the guy that he can kind of hitch his wagon to and say, okay,
like, this is my guy, this is my teammate, this is the dude I'm going to ride with, you know, to get myself to the to an opportunity to win, maybe win a championship one day, just get to the finals. On the West, Ant-Man, I mean, Ant-Man is the biggest budding superstar in the NBA right now. Hands down, no doubt. No doubt in my mind. The dude is incredible. He's good on defense. He's good on offense. He has an aesthetically pleasing style of playing basketball. He is an incredible athlete. And the Timberwolves are the top seed in the West right now. They overtook that from the Nuggets. I mean, that's what they are doing. Their turnaround from, like, this they're almost like the Knicks, just way less notoriety. This woe-begotten, woe-is-me franchise to now they are one of the top-tier NBA teams with a top-tier superstar in Anthony Edwards. And that is a huge turnaround, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. Not only that, look at Rudy Gobert. Rudy Gobert, who a lot of people thought was going to be out of the league after his season last year, is the leading candidate and is probably going to be the defensive player of the year. They have so many good pieces in Minnesota, and I'm so excited to kind of see the West giving us these young, exciting teams. Obviously, you have the Nuggets, who I talked about, Jokic, Murray, Aaron Gordon's still there. He plays such a prominent role, and in a lot of ways, he's their third best player. You know, Michael Porter Jr., who randomly will have 30-point outings. The Nuggets are the Nuggets. They're Denver. It's Denver and everybody else at this point in the NBA. The Oklahoma City Thunder, who have matured into one of the best young basketball teams I've seen in a long time. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has a legit... I forgot to bring him up in the MVP stuff. SGA has a legitimate MVP case. I don't think he'll win it because he's so young, and he doesn't have the historical relevance like a Giannis or a Jokic or a Luka to really garner the attention from the voters that he needs. But he has been impressive. The best two guard in the league, maybe the best guard period in the league. Then you have Chet Holmgren, who, a couple years ago got drafted from Gonzaga, got hurt. 2 years ago got drafted from Gonzaga, got hurt. And then he's come in this season and been absolutely incredible. He has lived up to the billing. We all thought that maybe he was a little too skinny, and he's still a little skinny, but Chet Holmgren's been awesome. He's been a very good rim protector. He's good at stretching the floor. And then you have Jay Will. Jay Will, number 8 for the Oklahoma City Thunder, who's been a shock. He's been the guy that's kind of sprung out of nowhere for Oklahoma City and really made them like a big time kind of contending team in the West, where they have become, in a lot of ways, Jalen Williams. He's been great. We love some Jalen Williams. I like Jalen Williams a lot, but so the Thunder are super solid. Then there's the Clippers, the Kawhi, James Harden, Paul George mix, which for a little bit there, they looked super dangerous. They went on a 30-10 kind of run throughout the last 2 months, and then but since then they've been slumping. They've had some really bad losses. They look kind of like an up and down franchise at the moment. Obviously, I talked about Luka and his Mavs. Another thing I didn't mention about the Mavs, I talked enough about Luka. I raved about Luka Doncic. He's probably my favorite player in the NBA right now. But Kyrie Irving has kept his head down. We all make fun of Kyrie because of some of the dumb shit he said. But he's kept his head down. He's played really well. Really well is even an understatement. He's been awesome, especially this last month. He dropped 48 on Tuesday, or I think Monday night. He dropped 48 points. The dude has been cooking, and he's kept his head down, kept out of the headlines. Kept out of the headlines for the wrong reasons. And him and Luka seem to have finally figured out how to play off of each other. I don't like their chances in the NBA playoffs, only because I don't think they have enough firepower yet. But man, anything's possible with Luka Doncic. He's been incredible. And if Kyrie keeps playing this way, this is a scary fucking team, dude. This is one of those teams in the West that when they bounced up to the 5 line, and they went on this little win streak that they've been on, and given Luka's playoff history, how well he plays in the playoffs. He is a top-tier playoff performer, and how well Kyrie plays in the playoffs, this is a team I wouldn't want to fucking see if I was any of these other teams in the West. If I'm the Clippers, I want no part of that in the first round. I want no part of that team in the first round at all. Like, if I'm the Clippers and the 4-5 matchup is me and Dallas, which is what it looks like it's going to be, I don't want no part of that shit, because that is death waiting to happen. The Phoenix Suns, who have been injury-prone all season with their big three. Man, do you all remember at the beginning of the season when we thought the Phoenix Suns were going to be really something when they traded for Bradley Beal? We all thought, man, the Phoenix Suns are going to be top-tier team, an elite team, and then they just weren't. Because they get hurt all the time. Bradley Beal's hurt like every other game. Kevin Durant sits out every other game. Booker's really the only one that keeps pushing. Now, when they're all on the court together, they're awesome. Especially Kevin Durant. I want to give Kevin Durant some love here. I've been called a Kevin Durant hater because, obviously I'm a big LeBron guy, for those who don't know. And you'll find that out the deeper we get into NBA coverage with football not on the, around. Especially once the NBA, you guys will find out how much I love LeBron on this podcast the deeper we get into NBA coverage and we get away after the NFL draft, away from the football. I love LeBron James, so people have called me a Kevin Durant hater because I've always said, and I stand by this, Kevin Durant is not on LeBron's level. Kevin Durant's incredible. I mean, he's the fact that he's basically been a 27 points a game, you can guarantee it, checkmark it off, ever since he hurt himself, ever since he tore his Achilles, is incredible to me. And he's been the same way this season. 27 points a game, mark it down. He's at least going to get 27, probably going to give you 30, maybe 40 on a good night. Devin Booker's a walking bucket. My concern for this team in the playoffs is obviously injury, but even if we just give them, nobody's going to get hurt. They don't have a lot of depth. So when they run into a team like, Denver or Minnesota or even Dallas, there's just not a lot of bodies to throw at these great players. The Pelicans, who, Brandon Ingram's been hurt on and off all season, so their future really depends on what he does. Zion Williamson has been great. This is really the first season since his rookie year that Zion has played a majority of the season, and he's been really good, but I think, you can kind of tell that he's lost a little something. And without B.I. there, they just don't have the firepower, I think, to get through. The Kings, who have had a really rough season compared to what they were last season when they were the three seed, when they were like, what was it, like they were there? I want to say they were the four seed or something like that. Like, they were up there. They had a really good season last season. It got cut short by the Golden State Warriors. Give me a sip here, ladies and gentlemen. And I really like Sacramento. I really like De'Aaron Fox. Again, Kentucky product, John Calipari recruit, De'Aaron Fox. He's great, and they've owned my Lakers. But, I don't see them going very far in the playoffs. They're just, they don't have the firepower, and De'Aaron needs help. As much as I like Sabonis, I don't know that he compares, when you compare him to these other great centers, when he matches up with someone like Gobert or Jokic or, anything like that, it's going to cause problems. The Lakers, who, this is my favorite NBA team, by the way. I've been a Lakers fan since I was a wee boy. My father is from Los Angeles, so I'm allowed to like the Lakers. You pieces of shit. I hear all you right now. I can feel you in the comments. Yes, I'm a LeBron guy. Yes, I'm a Lakers guy. When he signed with the Lakers like 3 years ago, it was one of the best days of my life. That being said, this Lakers team has been kind of up and down all season. They've had, which is shocking considering LeBron and AD have played all year. AD's been fantastic. Anthony Davis has been just a force of nature this season. So I can't wait to see what he does in the postseason. And a fully healthy LeBron could be interesting. The Lakers are one of those teams that could get really hot and get really interesting. It could be a lot like last season, where they are only a 7-8 seed in name only, and you have the two best players in the world, and they just start cooking, especially with all these young teams at the top. You have the Thunder, the Timberwolves, the Pelicans, all these teams kind of in the postseason. Really gives you an opportunity if you're if you're an all-time great like LeBron and you're a veteran elite player like AD, that you can really make some moves. And speaking of making moves, the Golden State Warriors are the last team on this list competing for a playoff spot. They will probably be in the play-in. I'm not counting out Steph Curry, who's been incredible this season. It's been amazing to me to watch him. So I'm not counting out Steph Curry yet. I can't do it. I can't bring myself to bet against Steph Curry yet. But this team feels a lot like last year's team, where they just don't have enough. I mean, there's just, the young players are starting to come around, but Klay is a shell of himself. Draymond is punching people out every other game and getting suspended. I mean, it just, to me, it feels like this just doesn't feel like the kind of team that can really makes a run and competes for a championship. I think they'll get into the postseason. I think they'll get past the play-in. But other than that, I mean, I think most of the teams in this conference are dogging them. Maybe outside of like Sacramento. Moving on to hockey, which is one of my favorite sports, baby. Oh, actually, let's talk about UFC 300 real quick, which is this weekend. It is headlined by Alex Pereira versus Jamahal Hill for the UFC Light Heavyweight Championship of the World, currently held by Alex Pereira. These dudes are big hitters. I wouldn't put money on this going the distance. I'd say at most, you're going to get 2-3 rounds out of this bad boy. This is a legacy fight, in my opinion, for Pereira. He has an opportunity to really establish himself as one of the best UFC like signings ever, having already won the middleweight title, now winning the light heavyweight title. He puts this defense on his record. He can really establish himself as one of the big stars going forward. Wele Zhang is going to fight. I'm not even going to attempt her name. Exoyanun? I'm awful. I'm sorry. Wele Zhang has looked unstoppable since reclaiming the 115-pound title. She has been mauling people, mopping up the competition. This was her last real challenge, was the first time these two fought. So it should be a hell of a fight between two premier fighters in this division. I got Wele Zhang. I mean, she's like a pit bull. What she's been doing to people has been ridiculous. I mean, she's mopping up these girls in this division. And then the big fight, probably the most anticipated fight of the night, is Justin Gaethje versus Max Holloway, because these are living legends. These are two living legends. Max Holloway is making the big move finally up to 155. Justin Gaethje has been one of the top tier premier fighters in this division for a very long time. This could establish a new number one contender at 155. You know, whoever wins this fight could really make a claim to be the next person to fight. God, what is his name? Islam Makhachev. The guy who wins this one could really make the claim that they should be the next in line, and it should be an absolute fucking banger of a fight. I mean, this should be worth the price of admission, baby. Justin Gaethje. I'm just gonna say it again. Justin Gaethje is gonna fight Max Holloway this weekend. If you're not excited, get excited. And then the NHL. We're going to close things off with hockey, one of my favorite sports. The playoff race in hockey. The Boston Bruins could potentially win the President's Cup this year in the East, the President's Trophy, which, for those who don't know, hockey gives out a trophy to the team that has the best statistical regular season in terms of wins and points scored and all that. It's called the President's Trophy, basically crowning them the winner of the regular season. Historically, President's Trophy winners do pretty well in the playoffs, although there is those times that they get knocked out. We all make fun of them. We all point and laugh. Ha ha. Is that going to happen to Boston? Now, what's funny is this Bruins team and the Celtics are so similar. They've both had a lot of postseason success. Like, this Bruins team has been to, I want to say, two cup finals. Not won one yet, been to a bunch of East Finals, and they've just never gotten over the hump of winning a championship. And that's kind of the same thing with the Celtics. And they, you know, this Bruins team has a lot of big stars with Brad Marchand and not Connor McDavid, Charlie McAvoy, and, you know, you have these big-time players who have a lot of postseason success, David Pastrnak, but don't seem to really make it happen when it matters. And that's kind of the story of Boston sports right now when it comes to the Celtics and the Bruins. So they could win the President's Trophy, but my question is that going to matter, or is this going to be another disappointing postseason for the Bruins and fans in Boston? I certainly hope so, because I hate the fans in Boston. The Florida Panthers have been the shock of the season. They are the second best team in the East right now, but the question for the Panthers is, are you guys for real? They made a run a couple years ago. They made a run last year to the Eastern Conference Finals, and I think it shocked everybody because the Panthers are in a lot of ways like, you know, one of the expansion franchises in the NBA. We're all just so used to them being, especially in the hockey world, being dog shit that we just don't expect them to be good. So it shocks us when over the last two seasons they've been one of the best teams in hockey. But the question is going to be, is this team really for real, or was last year kind of an aberration where they finally broke through and now they're just kind of happy with the success they're having? The New York Rangers are back, baby. They're young, they're high flying, they're talented. But the question, you know, Kaapo Kakko is great. They have Artemi Panarin, who I desperately miss being on my Chicago Blackhawks. They have one of the most fun to watch hockey teams in the NHL right now. But the question for them is kind of a similar question I have for another team in the West. Are they mature enough for a serious playoff run? Because, you know, overwhelmingly, it's the old teams that win in the hockey. It's the teams with the veterans, teams that have been through the wars and the playoffs, who have been through kind of those physical battles. The Maple Leafs have been steady all season, and Austin Matthews has been dynamite this year. I mean, he's on pace to score like the third most goals in the history of the league in a single season. So Austin Matthews has been fucking incredible this year. But the Leafs, the question with the Leafs is the same question we have about the Toronto Maple Leafs every year. Can they make any real noise in the NHL playoffs? Can they get close to that elusive cup, that cup that has gotten away from them for 60 seasons? I mean, in a lot of ways, the Maple Leafs are the New York Knicks of hockey. They are a premier brand in the sport. They are maybe the premier brand in the sport. Well, I wouldn't say the premier brand in the sport is my Chicago Blackhawks, but they are one of the premier brands in the sport. And Austin, they have incredible players. I mean, they have Austin Matthews, and I want to say they still have, who is the forward that used to play for the Islanders. But they have incredible players, but it just always never seems to work out for them. And then in the West, the Dallas Stars are the real deal, baby. I mean, these Dallas Stars are real good, and they're real scary looking, and they are looking for another chance at claiming the Stanley Cup. It would be their second Stanley Cup, I believe, in the last five seasons. I think they won in 2020. Don't quote me on that, but I remember watching that finals. I think that was the finals between them and Boston. I want to say they went to Game 7. Yes. They are looking for the opportunity. So there are still some players on that team from that run. So they have veterans. They have dudes that have done it before. They have dudes that have lifted that Stanley Cup, which, by the way, great. 10 toes down, I will stand on this to the day I die. Best trophy in sports. They are for real, and they could be. They might be the West's participant. The Vancouver Canucks are 100% also for real this season. They have been dynamite. They have been so fun to watch. Elias Patterson. What's their goalie's name? Oh, I'll never remember it now. I hate myself. But they are incredible to watch. One of the best young teams in hockey. Congratulations to Vancouver. They were fucking awful for a couple years in there, for about half the decade. But now they're awesome. The question with Vancouver is the same question I had with New York. Is this team just too young to make a serious postseason run? Are they just too inexperienced? They haven't been through these wars, have been in these moments. Speaking of a team that has been in these moments, that won a cup, I believe, two seasons ago in 2022, the Colorado Avalanche are back, baby. Nathan MacKinnon he has been on a tear as of late, and he has put them firmly in the top three of the Western Conference. This is a dangerous hockey team. I mean, they can score, they can defend, they are a terrifying hockey team. I mean, this feels like a team that when they get in the postseason, they're the team that's going to go on the run. I mean, it feels like it's inevitable that we're going to get the Avalanche in at least the Western Conference Finals this year. And could there be another parade in Denver? Possibly. Could there be two parades in Denver this year for both the Nuggets and the Avalanche? It's possible. And then Winnipeg. Winnipeg is back, baby. Finally back in serious contention. But they have a checkered playoff history. So I think the farthest they've been was in a Western Conference Finals against my Blackhawks. And ever since then, they've kind of just disappointed everybody. And then you just have to ask yourself, what are the Edmonton Oilers? Are the Edmonton Oilers the team we've seen recently? Or are they the team that they're so up and down? First off, they have maybe the best player in the sport in Connor McDavid, who's just been trapped in Edmonton his entire career. And they have games where they look like they are absolute dynamite, and then they have games where they look like they are one of the worst teams in this league. So I am just infinitely confused about what's going on in Edmonton. They need to make up their mind and pick a lane, like either trade Connor McDavid or get good. And then Vegas is the last time I want to talk about. I'm not ready to count out the defending champs just yet. I know they're down there in the wild card. I know they're down there struggling away, but Jack Eichel was hurt most of the season. They've taken some time to get their feet underneath of them. I don't want it because, well, I do kind of want it because watching a team in Vegas win the Stanley Cup and then watching all the Canadian team fan bases go absolutely apeshit over that was super fun for me. But I think there's a chance here that the Vegas Golden Knights make a serious run. I mean, if they get in, they just won the title. I mean, all those guys are back, and they have one of the best young players in the sport in Jack Eichel. So the idea that they couldn't make another big run, they have Jack Eichel, Mark Stone, that they couldn't make another run through these NHL Stanley Cup playoffs and get to the Western Conference Finals, maybe get to the Stanley Cup Finals, is ridiculous. Vegas is a dangerous wild card team if they're completely healthy and they get in the race. Woo! And then looking at the Hart Trophy, we talked about Nate MacKinnon, the forward for the Colorado Avalanche. He's been absolutely incredible. Nikita Kucherov, who is like single-handedly keeping the Lightning in the playoff hunt in the East, he's amazing. I mean, Nikita Kucherov is a dog. Shout out to my friend Kyle Sullivan, who's a big Tampa Bay Lightning fan. Dude, you guys got a dog down there, and you got to build. Tampa's got to build. Now, first off, they built a couple years ago, they had like the Avengers of hockey. It was insane. They won two straight titles, and they were just dog walking people on their way there. And Nikita Kucherov was awesome then. He's still awesome now. And then the guy I just talked about, the best player in the sport, in my opinion, Connor McDavid, who people don't talk about because he's in Edmonton. But this dude is off the chain, dog. Which, by the way, for people who don't know, the Hart Trophy is the like NHL equivalent of the MVP. This dude's off the chain. I mean, he's so good at hockey. He's such a great player, and I think he deserves the Hart Trophy this year. If it's not him, someone else I brought up was Auston Matthews. I think Auston Matthews should be in these discussions. He's not because the Maple Leafs are the Maple Leafs, but Connor McDavid should absolutely win the Hart Trophy, and Connor McDavid should absolutely find any way he can to get the fuck away from Edmonton. And that, ladies and gentlemen, does it. Thank you for tuning in to this second episode of Average Joe's Sports Show. Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, Pandora, Amazon, and iHeartRadio. Check us out on social media, The Average Joe Sports Show on Facebook, Average Joe Sports Show on Instagram. You can check out clips of this podcast as well as my other podcasts on the Planet Comedy YouTube channel. Same thing on the Planet Comedy TikTok. You can check me out on Twitter at Stoplight Jesus. Follow us on Twitch at Stoplight Jesus, where me and Cam stream video games. You know, have a good time. We play a lot of Helldivers. We're spreading freedom and democracy out here as I'm trying to talk about sports. And thank you guys so much for listening. Have a wonderful rest of your day or night, and I'll see you in 2 weeks right here at Average Joe's.